And it's showing up at the top of the screen now for if you haven't turned it up. But yeah.
Yeah,
Okay.
it's interesting. And I don't have my usual option to change the from the musician sound to the non-musician sound, which then influences the sound of my bell, because I always flip it over so that to the musician microphone, because Zoom suppresses background noise and suppresses microphone or bell sounds. So if I think when I ring a bell.
I think that if you go down in the bottom of your screen, it's on mine, it's on the left-hand side, and then there's a little arrow that points up next to the audio, and you can do audio settings on there.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I'm sorry we're recording all this. Yeah, I still don't see the option, but I'll figure it out. So, to say that today is May 21st, 2024. We are reaching peak weather in the Bay Area. It is fantastic. And we paid a long winter price for it, so we are very grateful. So we'll sit for 20 minutes and then going to come back to More Than Mindfulness, the book that I started working with some time back. It's been months, I think. And I don't think we've gotten back to it in a little while. So just settling back into a comfortable meditation posture. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. Turning the attention inward. Letting the body settle. Becoming aware of the breath. The breath coming in, the breath going out. And what is it that you bring with you today to this period of meditation? How are you feeling? Are there persistent thoughts or concerns? And can you let go? Just be with you. Or whatever body. Resting in the present moment. So there can be a sense of just releasing as we begin a meditation. Letting any tension in the body drain off. Right. Bringing the attention to the breath, having the breath into the foreground of awareness. Thoughts, images in the mind fade into the background. Your perspective. We're encouraged to take as one. Viewing experience through the broader lens or a detached, impersonal lens. But what we are seeing is change. We are seeing causality. Our feelings trigger thoughts, thoughts trigger feelings. Now one thought reminds us of a memory. The whole cause and effect. Relationship. You see how grasping after such thoughts triggers uncomfortable feelings. Okay. The second level too. Though this practice is oriented less towards content than process. To see our experience in impersonal, but not our story. We may encounter a tension between the conditioned mental habits that want to keep spinning out and the meditative intention to let go. We see the strength of our grasping, of our clinging. 12 steps, step six addresses this issue. When it encourages us to be entirely ready to let go. And so in our meditation, we see the actual challenge of that step. Why it's not as simple as it might seem. You think, of course, I'm ready. I want to let go. But then, as we sit with the real time experience, we are faced with the power of that, and that deeply conditioned habit pattern. That was the bell, in case you couldn't hear it. Beware the upgrade. Well, was a bit of a sonic interruption there. Sorry about that. Someone lost control of their mute button, apparently, and after their second unmuting of themselves, I removed them from the meeting. I have no patience. Thank you. Actually, no, I want to have to protect the meeting. All right, so good morning again. As I mentioned, I'm getting back to the book More Than Mindfulness by Giri Honestery. Available as a free download. I also have a hard copy here. And I'm on, if you have a hard copy, it's page 55, Ajahn Pasano's talk called Being the One Who Knows. I have some notes on this, but I actually thought I would just read some of this because it's a very rich, it's quite short. It's like 5 pages, but it's really full of good stuff. So this is Being the One Who Knows, Ajahn Pasano. This talk was given at Abhayagiri Monastery on January 7th, 2021. That would be in the midst of the pandemic, January 7th, day after January 6th. What do you know? Interesting. I didn't notice that before. This is the beginning of the day of our group practice, the beginning day of our group practice, and the first day of getting our routine and rhythm going. So that means this is the beginning of their 3-month winter retreat. The very first talk he gives, so, which I think makes it particularly interesting, because here he is kind of setting up the monastic community for their retreat. Here are some reflections on practice. This is an opportunity for focusing and cultivating our meditation practice. We have 3 months of winter retreat, but I would be hesitant to encourage the perception that all of this is only a meditation retreat. This is an opportunity for deepening our whole approach to practice. It is certainly how Ajahn Chah approached practice, and I would venture to say how the Buddha approached practice. Sorry, little cough here. This is a complete path of cultivation of body, speech, and mind. It is a complete path of sila, samadhi, and panya, of ethical conduct, concentration, and discernment. I think it helps to make that conscious. It is easy to slip into that sense of me and my meditation, and how's my meditation going, and how's your meditation going? The approach is to open up and broaden the perspective of what we are actually doing. I think it's a great theme to be pursuing, the theme of Buddha Nusati, Buddha Nusati, the recollection of the Buddha, because we are putting ourselves into a larger context. Years ago, I was struck when Lungpor Samedo started reflecting in that way. He said that the perspective is to come back and embody or settle into the sense of the Buddha seeing the Dhamma. This is what we are really trying to do. The one who knows, seeing the way things truly are. By doing that and including oneself in that process is in itself a Sangha. With the three refuges, what we are really trying to do is enter into, embody, incorporate, and make real these three refuges of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha in our hearts. It's a really, you know, rich opening, and it resonates so much for me, and I think for recovery, because, and he goes on to talk some more. I may read some more, but just to comment a little bit on this, that he's immediately putting our practice in this larger context, not suggesting that we're just meditating to meditate, you know, or to have some experience, or that even that meditation is some magical thing, but that it's part of this larger process of sila samadhipanya. So sila samadhipanya, which he's saying, calling ethical conduct, concentration, and discernment, is often called morality, meditation, and insight or wisdom. But, you know, whatever language we use, it's shorthand for the Eightfold Path. So the Eightfold Path is what the Buddha taught for living, for freedom, for, you know, finding a release from stress, from suffering. And again, it connects to our recovery because it's about how we live, how we take care of ourselves, our mind, and how we see the world, how we interpret our experience. So that's kind of my expanding on the idea of sila samadhipanya. So how we live, I think, can get overlooked in the when we get obsessed with meditation as some kind of a magical thing. Like, you know, I'll go back, as I often do, to my early practice when I wasn't sober. And I thought that just meditating was going to fix me, rather than seeing that, no, you're creating karma by your thoughts, words, and deeds, and particularly with your actions, with your deeds. And the first thing you have to do is to live in a wholesome manner. And that's, of course, what recovery starts with, letting go of the addictive behavior. And then we start to then, you know, taking care of the mind is really, this is where the meditation is really applied. And it's vital, because if we just get sober and start to live in a more wholesome way, that's great. We're not doing harm, but the inner life can still be terribly agitated and disturbed and toxic. And so our meditation, first of all, can have this calming effect on that. This is why it's used for stress reduction. You know, to just learn to stop, to breathe, to just settle, let things settle. But then further, to start to see what are those unhelpful, unwholesome, toxic mental habits? And can I let go of them, or can I change those habits? There are many different aspects of the practices that address this. So bringing loving kindness where there's resentment, you know, stepping out of the self view when we are caught up in self obsession or you know, self judgment, and starting to see things So here, this then brings in the wisdom view, the Buddha seeing the Dhamma, saying, "Oh, what's going on here is this conditioned way of thinking." And if we can see that it's a conditioned way of thinking, we realize that it's not real in the sense of having, of containing truth, but it's rather generated through past habits, through things people have said to us, through traumatic or difficult experiences in our lives, or even through pleasant, delightful experiences in our lives. But that all of it is just that what we're thinking in this moment is all just the result of past conditioning, past experiences, which include just the genetic conditioning. And so when we are able to see that in real time, then we don't get so attached to or so aversive to what's appearing in the mind. We're able to say, oh, this is just that. This is just negative thinking. This is just an old beliefs. So our meditation helps us to zero in and clarify those things that arise and change this viewpoint to step into a viewpoint of wisdom, of right view, rather than the one of self view and believing whatever appears in the mind. So again, what we're getting at here is that there's this whole path that depends upon all three of these aspects, the ethical behavior, the meditative, cultivation, and the wisdom view. So I'll read some more. There are many meditation techniques and methods. We will be covering some of them through this winter retreat, but I would like to make a plea for you to broaden your perspective. Hold it in a way that does not end up about me trying to get ahead in my meditation, or me trying to feel good in my meditation, or me trying to enhance my worldly goals of some kind of confidence or self-identity, or trying to prop up a quote, spiritual identity. Me, the meditator, me, the successful meditator, me, the successful monastic, me, the whatever. What it is about and what it always comes back to is the freedom from suffering. This is the perspective that the Buddha gave from his very first teaching through to the end of his life. It was characterized as the elephant's footprint that encompasses all the teachings. That sense of the purpose being freedom from suffering, it manifests in different ways. It can be described in many different ways, and it has all sorts of philosophical nuances. The overarching perspective is to recognize that there is not an annihilation of self in order to get something, but it is the Buddha seeing the Dhamma. The one who knows, seeing the way things truly are. So let me go back here a little bit. First of all, I just really appreciate that he, is encouraging us not to think of meditation sort of as this personal project, and further as sort of an isolated, this is how I'm hearing it, as sort of an isolated project that I'm like working on my meditation game to get really good at meditating. And once I do that, then what? Then ego will be happy for 5 minutes. It's like, no, becoming good meditator is not the point of this work. Meditation is serving a purpose. And I want to then also point to this. He mentions the elephant's footprint, which is a simile that shows up in the suttas, and it refers to the Four Noble Truths. So there's the Four Noble Truths, there's the core Buddhist teaching on suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the way to the end of suffering. And the Buddha says that all of the teachings, all of his teachings fit into that Four Noble Truths in the same way that all other bipeds or quadrupeds, anything with feet, its footprint will fit into an elephant's footprint. Does that make sense? I'm not describing it very well. So now I want to come to this phrase, the Buddha seeing the Dhamma, the one who knows seeing the way things truly are. So this is a phrase that we understand comes from Ajahn Chah and maybe predates him, but this is where most of us have encountered this. And Ajahn Sumedho very much picked it up, and Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Amaro and all the people in the Thai forest tradition like to use this line, the Buddha seeing the Dhamma. So it's first of all, it's in the context of the three refuges, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And it's saying that the Buddha in this formulation refers not to the historical Buddha, but to the Buddha mind, the awakened mind. The word Buddha means awake. So to just say, when you are awake, when you are mindful, which is another more prosaic way of saying awake, then when you look at things, when you look at reality, you see the truth, because you have this wise eye. You're looking with the eye of wisdom. And so they're suggesting that taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dhamma means that you are committing yourself to try to always be awake. And in that awakeness, to look at your experience through the lens of truth rather than through the lens of self. So just to distinguish what that means, the lens of truth means fundamentally that we're looking at the three characteristics of existence, though it can be broader than that, but we are seeing the impermanent nature of things, the unsatisfactory nature of things, and the impersonal nature of things. Dukkha or anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, suffering, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. So, according to the Buddha, everything is of this nature. These has this nature. These are called the three characteristics of existence. So when we see things through the lens of self, it's pretty obvious what that means. I have a thought and I think, oh, I have to do something about this. I have to fix this. This means something about me or about you or about the world. And there's something that has to be done about it. There's a grasping, there's a wanting, or there's an aversion. There's this whole proliferation, this of samsara, sort of the arising of like next thing, do the next thing, do that. Now I have to do the next thing. When we look at it through the lens of Dhamma, what we realize is, oh, this thought is triggering discomfort. It's just a thought. It's not real. It's not me. It's just passing through. It's impermanent. And so when I have that view, I'm not disturbed by it. It's just like, oh, yeah, there's another cloud passing through. So this is the view that the Buddha is pointing to, and it's what particularly for me is very helpful about Thai forest tradition, that it's giving us a very specific, very practical, and very simple way to take refuge in the Dhamma in each moment. Just, I don't have to remember everything. You know, if I can remember just one of those things, if I can just remember everything is impermanent, or if I can remember, oh, clinging causes suffering, or if I can remember it's not about me, just one of those things will tend to dissipate the disturbing quality of any thought or feeling. So this is the strategy that kind of comes through the Thai forest tradition and Ajahn Chah particularly. And you can see why, you know, they're saying, like, don't make it just about meditation, because meditation can turn into something that goes exactly counter to all these things. Just as Ajahn Pasano is saying, it can turn into a me project, and it can turn into me trying to stop the world, like trying to make a mind state permanent. I'm going to get enlightened and then I'm always going to be fine. And it can turn into me clinging to something, or me trying to get rid of something so that it's creating suffering. So that's the opposite of the three characteristics, or sort of the opposite of the skillful response to the three characteristics. So we want to really see what the role of meditation is and apply it in our lives, but not lose sight of its role in the larger context of this practice and of these teachings. Well, I feel like I've said a lot, and maybe we started early, but I haven't rambled on as long as I usually do. So I'm just going to open it up and see if there are any comments or questions. Well. Okay, Kathy.
Hello, Kevin and
Hello.
everybody. I love this book and I love you reading to us. It's so good. I've learned so much from you. You're my first teacher. I started during the pandemic and I didn't know anything, and I still don't, but I'm learning from you. And I found that guy from Friday night because I thought it was Spirit Rock Night. I was looking for you. And then I found him by accident, the man from Wisconsin. And oh, I learned so much. And I donated too. And he really got me riled up and going. So thank you for everything you've helped me with. Very grateful to you and everybody here. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy. Oh, Rita, hi.
Hi, Kevin. Hi. Listen, thanks for today's talk. That was really good. I'll be honest, just recently I've been a little bit uncertain how this practice can fit in with my 12-step program, given that the core of my disease is self-absorption. And sometimes when with this meditation business, I don't know whether I've utilized it correctly, but I was starting to think, oh my God, this is isolating me a bit, and this is all about Rita achieving a state of, and it's so contrary to my program of selflessness. And I still haven't mastered it. I mean, I love the all of this, but I just need to put it in relation to my 12-step program so that I can be productive with it, so that I to use meditation as something to be able to use the steps or whatever it is, this program, to help others. I got to the stage where everything was so important that I did my meditation because I was going to become something greater than the average alcoholic who hadn't quite got sobriety. You know what I'm talking about.
I do, yes.
I'm looking at this and saying, okay, it's not, you know, maybe I've been a bit extreme. This tool of meditation can be used within the realm of the 12-step program. Because I've been sober for some years now and I love it, but I'm just still trying to see how can I work this in to be, you know, better in my sobriety, to be of service to others. Thank you.
That's great. Thanks, Rita. And yeah, this is, you know, very much what I'm talking about here. Seeing what the role of meditation is in recovery. Meditation is not a recovery program. But when you talk about the self-obsession, meditation reveals that on this profound level. And that's what I think is one of the things that's quite valuable. There's many things that I think are valuable about it, but that's one of the things that really is valuable about it. When we start to really understand what this meditative process is about, is like investigating and seeing how our mind operates. It's not about getting to this bliss state. I mean, that can happen and it's great and it's helpful as well. It has a benefit. But when we see how the self-obsession manifests in the mind in real time, and then, so that's very revealing. And then we learn to let go just in the simple way of breathing, coming back to the breath and letting the thought pass. That gives us a strategy for our ordinary lives as well, that we can call upon when we're in our lives and we're finding ourselves getting, you know, wrapped up in me, and to breathe and stop, take one breath, take three breaths, and oh, all right, there I go again. I feel like the meditation helps us to map out these, like, how the mind works in ways that we can't ordinarily see, because what's going on in the mind is happening so rapidly in our daily life that we can't really stop and capture the whole pattern that's being revealed. But in meditation, because we're not doing anything else, we can start to see those patterns and then get better at letting go. And that is certainly one key aspect of it. And the other thing that came up during the guided meditation just by accident today was step six, and how we see, you know, that step six says we were entirely ready, and it says about God, but if we let go of God, we were entirely ready to let go. That's what I think that step is about. We're entirely ready to change. And when we're meditating, we can see the resistance to that. We can realize, oh, like, that sounds all well and good in the step, like, okay, God, please, yeah, I'm ready. Like, most of us probably think we are ready. But in meditation, again, because we're looking at things more precisely, more microscopically, we can actually see the clinging, we can see the resistance. And the resistance is revealed simply by the fact that we can't stop thinking. You know, like, oh, wait, like, there's something going on here that I'm not in control of, you know. And so, you know, ready isn't quite the term that we would use in meditation or in Buddhism, but it's referring to the same thing. The ability to let go, our capacity to let go, our resistance to letting go. And this is, you know, it's very humbling to see, like, wow, my habit patterns, my mental patterns, my grasping, my wish to keep thinking, which is about me and my story and my fears, you know, that's very hard to stop. It's very hard to let go. So again, the meditation becomes very revealing, and it gives us more wisdom and more understanding about the nature of our disease and the nature of our mind. Anya, hello.
Hello. So I've just been sitting here giggling because this made me think of meditation as a competitive sport and how hilarious that would be. You know, like what would Olympic level competitive meditation look like? You know, and how would you even judge it? So,
We'd have to have MRIs. People would be enclosed and having fMRI
I mean,
tracking.
it's just such a funny notion, and but it's so helpful to me because I do have a competitive streak. I always have, and you know, I have to watch that, and watch if that feeling comes up, not just during meditation for me, but other aspects of my life too. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thanks, Tanya. And I'll be seeing you in a couple of weeks in Atlanta. I wanted to mention before the end of the hour that I am doing a half day retreat for Spirit Rock with Vimalasara on June 2nd, I think. Let's see, June 2nd, yes. So if you're interested in that, check out the Spirit Rock website. That's enough for now for advertising. Robin, hello.
Hi. Okay, I'm going to try and be quick because I know I can be long-winded. First, I want to say, yes, you're Kevin. Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm so grateful for your presence coming into my life because you're my first teacher too. I want to thank you for that. I heard you say when you were talking about the Four Noble Truths, and you know what a baby I am in this, but I heard the first three steps there. I heard steps one, two, and three in the Four Noble Truths. I don't know if that's just me. I don't know if whatever, but that's a real strong connection I got there. The last thing I want to say is that with this new to me past month meditating on a daily basis, really working on it, I am finding myself catching in whatever situation in the out in the world, walking my dog and something annoying happens, or you know whatever, I'm with somebody and I get annoyed or irritated because that's what happens to me. I'm seeing it different. I'm seeing those thoughts just like when I'm meditating and go, oh, I'm just going to breathe and let that go. And it is an amazing, unexpected surprise that's happened to me. So how cool is that? So I appreciate you. I really
That's
do.
beautiful. Yeah, I mean that's what this practice is certainly one of the things it's meant to help us to do, and certainly inspiring when we start to see that it's working. That's great. Thank you for the testimonial. All right. Well, we'll continue week by week to do this class. And I will be out on the road in a few weeks, in Alabama for a retreat, and then in Indiana. But I will try to keep coming up for Tuesday nights. There may have to be a sub one time. I'm not sure how it's going to all play out. Julie used to ask me, she hasn't been around lately, to sort of offer something at the end. And so yeah, I think reflecting on this idea of the Buddha seeing the Dhamma is a really useful one in your practice, that this is what refuge really is. It's not some just ritual that we do, that it's really about an orientation in our life. And it's not that you're going to maintain that orientation 24/7, but just as a keep coming back. To just keep coming back to that reflection. So I offer that for your day and for your week. And I thank you all for showing up. Be well.
Let's step in.
All right. Thanks, Monica.
Thank you.